Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 10th of November. Monday at 9 means all things political, and our guest this hour joined us during campaign season and now joins us post-election. Professor David Lanoux is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. We'll be looking at a number of issues this hour. I guess the big question of the hour is whether or not the president-elect needs to think big rather than think small. And what thinking big means. We'll look at the economic transition team and his press conference, first press conference on Friday. Today's visit to the White House, Michelle Obama and Barack Obama are meeting with the Bushes today at the White House to get a tour. We'll talk about that. And we'll look at the issues that you hope the president-elect will be taking on right away. There is news of a proposal to ship imprisoned terrorism suspects to the United States to face criminal trials, and some expected changes when it comes to executive authority. So we'll look at that as well. If there are certain people you'd like to recommend for a cabinet position, we can certainly entertain those questions as well this hour. Our phone number, as it always is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor David Lanoux is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. His research focus is American politics and teaching interests, American government and politics, and elections and political participation. Professor Lanoux, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here again. Let's start with an overriding question, and then we'll take it into specifics, whether or not this new president needs to think big rather than think small.
Well, I think that's probably the best thing for him. He has a very unusual mandate. He's coming in with a large majority in both the House and the Senate. He was elected with the first majority for a Democrat since it's either 1976 or 1964. So he really has to get out of the gate quickly. I think people are accustomed to thinking after Roosevelt of the first 100 days of a presidency. And so he needs to develop a clear agenda and try to move that agenda through Congress fairly early.
Is it unusual for a president-elect to have a press conference, to gather economic advisors, and to receive as much press attention a couple days after he's been elected as it was for Obama?
Well, I think it is a little bit unusual, and partly that's because Barack Obama's presidency, his candidacy, has been so unusual in so many ways. And also the fact that I think people are really hoping for some kind of change very quickly when he takes office. In some ways, President Bush has become more and more irrelevant as the months have gone by. And so, in a sense, Obama is commanding the stage here almost as the president in waiting.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of change, when you say that we're expecting change quickly, where the change? Are we expecting to, I guess the economy is number one, are we expecting to him to make sure that our pensions are secure, that there are many jobs in the country? Could we see a New Deal kind of era?
Well, I think we're going to see maybe a scaled-down version of an Obama New Deal.
Mm.
One of the things he has to do immediately is he has to deal with the unemployment problem. I think he's going to propose a stimulus package, which is much more bold than anything that President Bush had done. That'll be job one. In addition, I think he's going to force a lot stronger regulation on the financial markets to try to avoid the problems that we've had over the past couple of years. So those are things domestically I think he has to start with. A stimulus package, deal with unemployment, put some rules down to keep this financial crisis from occurring again. And then probably, as I think you said in the introduction, he's going to look at some things on the international scale, on the war on terrorism, possibly shutting down Guantanamo, bringing the prisoners to the United States, laying down the law on things like torture and interrogation.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with unemployment. What does he need to do? Do you anticipate that unemployment is going to be going up gradually or quickly? And what does a president do to deal, and what indications do you have of the way that he would deal with unemployment in this country?
Well, it's going to be difficult because unemployment, is going up. It seems like it's going to keep going up for a while because of the economic slowdown. I mean, these things always have a lag period, even under the best of circumstances. So it's going to be tough, and there are limits. I think most Americans don't really understand fully that there are limits to what a president can do to solve these sorts of problems. Now, there are short-term things you can do to try to get the country over the hump and hopefully get them wait for the economic recovery to occur. And I think that's what Obama's going to do. There'll be probably a short-term jobs program, a stimulus program to put even more money into the economy to get private employers to hire more people. Things like that, I think, will probably be first on the drawing board.
Mm-hmm. What about the auto industry?
Well, there, I think that he's certainly looking in that direction. And there are, you know, there are things he could do. Incentives he could create, tax incentives for the auto industry. Possibly consider the, you know, the balance of trade and the effect that has. I don't think he's going to be looking at things like, you know, higher tariffs or anything, you know, fairly radical like that. But he's already indicated he's going to focus on the auto industry as one of the key areas.
Mm-hmm. What did you make of the team of economic advisors that he brought in and were flanking him as he gave his first press conference on Friday?
Well, it's a very strong team. It's a team that really, you know, spans to some extent partisanship and ideology. It's also a team that signals that we are not going to see radical change. I mean, these are people who are well respected on Wall Street, well respected in the Washington community. So I think he's signaling that, you know, change is coming, but it's not going to be anything wrenching or unusual.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, I've been wondering this for some time. I'm reading a book about Abraham Lincoln for later in this week, and it's specifically on the transition time from when he was elected on November 6, 1860, until he was inaugurated on March 4, which seems like this interminably long period of time. And now it seems to me that January 20th seems like it's a long period of time as well. Has there ever been any movement to change when inauguration takes place, or are we just living in such a fast world now that we expect him to be inaugurated a week from when he's elected?
Well, of course, we had the change that moved the inauguration from, I think it was March to January as transportation and all the infrastructure got better. I think you need to give a new president time to put a team together. I mean, I understand, of course, the problem right now is that, you know, President Bush is the lamest of lame ducks. His popularity is so low, people have lost confidence in him. And yet there's nothing Barack Obama can do for the next, you know, 2 months and change. But the thing he can do and he has to do is he has to put his team together. He has to set up his agenda. Those are things you can't really do overnight. And I understand, of course, that, you know, as it became clearer that he would likely win the election, he started thinking about these things. But you can't go from campaign mode to governing mode immediately. You know, maybe you could change it to January 1st or something like that, but it's really not that big of a difference.
Mm-hmm. What about President Bush's use of executive authority? How has he used that? And what about Obama's expected changes on the issues that have been brought up, or stem cell research, offshore drilling?
Well, I think you'll see some of the executive orders that President Bush initiated being reversed by the new president. Stem cell research, of course, is one of the obvious ones. That's very popular. He'll do that immediately. He'll probably remove the gag order on federal funding and abortion. That's something that seems to bounce back and forth between Democrats and Republicans when they take office. But I think the thing that Obama has to also wrestle with is the larger question of executive power and how that's changed under the Bush administration. On the one hand, I think that, you know, he needs to scale that back somewhat, but he has to do it in such a way that he doesn't announce, you know, the weakness of his own position. So I think, you know, there are certain cosmetic things he can do. He can certainly cut down or eliminate the number of signing declarations. When President Bush signed a bill and then would add his own opinion about what the bill really entailed and whether it was constitutional and those sorts of things, I think the signing statements will be a lot fewer and a lot less bold under Obama.
Is he going to be able to move quickly on an issue that we've talked about so much and is so important to Americans, and that's health care reform?
Well, that's really the tough one. I mean, you know, Bill Clinton came into office in 1992 promising that under very different circumstances, obviously. Things were not nearly as bad in 93 as they are today. But that's going to be one of the real challenges. I think that the two things domestically where Obama has a mandate would be, one, to deal with the current economic situation and the unemployment, and two, to do something about health care. He He had a policy. He made it very clear during the debates, during the campaign, what he was going to do. But now, of course, he deals with Congress, and he'll have a Democratic Congress, but he'll have a Democratic Congress that, you know, has to worry about their relationship with their contributors, that has to worry about getting reelected, that has to worry about the ads being run against them. He's going to run into some of the same stuff that that Bill and Hillary Clinton ran into, although from a stronger vantage point. What he needs to do, though, is he needs to get in there and work with his party in Congress, work with the interest groups, and do something the Clintons did not do, which was to build consensus as he goes along, and hopefully try to try to get his program through as quickly, but also as much based on consensus as possible. And it's going to be difficult. It's going to be, I think, more difficult than most Americans imagine.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about the way he conducted his campaign? The New Yorker has a really interesting article on how Obama won, which you can get online. Very, very disciplined. People who were not in the limelight, who worked behind the scenes, who organized people all over this country. It was just a remarkable effort. And from all indications, he was very, very even keeled during the whole campaign, never very up, never very down, just sort of steady. Can you surmise anything from the way he ran this really quite remarkable campaign as to how he will govern?
Well, I think one thing that's very clear, as you say, is that this was probably the single most disciplined campaign for president that I think I've ever seen. It was on message, it was on focus, and it never got distracted by the sorts of things that seem to distract politics and politicians in America. And that bodes well for his presidency. I think that he and Rahm Emanuel and his major advisors are sitting down now, and they're putting together what their plan will be for the first year, the way they put together their plan for the for running for president a year and a half ago. And if you look at the way he ran for president, I mean, there were times, the most notable, of course, when Sarah Palin joined the ticket on the Republican side, and it looked like McCain was building a lead, and people were screaming for Obama to go negative. He had to show some passion. He had to attack. And he and his people basically sat there and said, we have our plan. We have confidence in our plan. We're going to stick with our plan. And one of the problems, I think, with the Clinton administration early on was there was a lot of kind of improvisation. When things became a problem, gays in the military, health care, they just sort of kept moving back and forth and improvising as they went along. I don't think you'll see that from an Obama administration. I think you'll see that they'll have a clear plan, they'll stick to the plan, they'll be very disciplined about it, and that will likely be successful.
Mm-hmm. It is, when you think about it, a very important time for them, isn't it? When they are making all these appointments, when they're considering who will be a part of a team here, the cabinet appointments, et cetera. That's crucial for running your government.
Oh, absolutely. It's crucial in two ways. First of all, of course, it's crucial in the sense of finding the right people, and the right kind of Obama people. I mean, Obama people, at least judging from the campaign, are people who are going to be team players. They're going to buy into the general thrust of the Obama message and the Obama platform. They're not going to be the sort who are going to leak to the press. But they're also going to be people who have very clear expertise. Barack Obama is not afraid to surround himself by people who are every bit as smart as he is and very knowledgeable about their field. The second aspect is a symbolic aspect, and I think they're still working on that. What does the creation of your cabinet say about you as a new president? Is he going to choose Republicans, for example, for very high-profile jobs, or is he just going to use them for window dressing the way that President Bush and to some extent Bill Clinton did? Is he going to pick people from a wide diversity of not just ethnic and racial groups, but ideology, geography, and different sorts of interests? I think the symbolism of this new cabinet is going to matter almost as much early on as the content.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that he should put Republicans in the cabinet?
I think he will. I think, you know, most presidents, including President Bush, have put the other party in the cabinet, although usually not in very high-level positions. My guess is that Obama's going to do something fairly dramatic, that he's going to find either for Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Homeland Security, one of the high-profile positions is going to be filled by a Republican, and a Republican who is, in most ways, fairly conservative.
Hmm. Any suggestions or possibilities? Not suggestions, but who do you think that might be?
Well, they've talked about, for defense, they've talked about keeping Robert Gates in, for example, which, I mean, it doesn't sound dramatic, but in some ways that would be dramatic, and would be, you know, kind of a nod toward continuity, and also a nod toward some of the successes that the Bush administration has had recently. They've also talked about Chuck Hagel, the recently retired senator from Nebraska, a very conservative senator, but somebody that Barack Obama has a lot of respect for, especially in the area of foreign policy, and a critic of Bush's Iraq policy. They've talked about other people on the Republican side who would have an equally high profile, Dick Lugar, for example, from Indiana.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and we'll take them momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, or send an email if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. It is now President-elect Barack Obama. So now what is the question of the hour? And our guest is professor and department chair of political science at the University of Alabama, David Lanoux. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now, starting with Rick. Hi, Rick.
Oh, good morning. I'd like to keep the conversation on the light side. I'd like to start by just saying that with this unprecedented $700 million spent on this last campaign, that expectations have been raised to a fever pitch, not only in the United States but across the world. I have friends who have a 20-month-old infant, and whenever the television set comes on, he screams out, "Barack Obama!" But what I'd like to suggest is that people in the world have such high expectations for our new leader that they've got a whole list of things they expect him to be able to solve, starting with global warming, tensions in the Middle East, you know, Russian misbehavior by invading sovereign nations. And so Barack Obama isn't so much the president of the world. He has become our global husband.
That's something to live up to. That can be a difficult task, to say the least, Professor Lanoux.
The expectations are going to be pretty daunting.
Yes.
I think that a lot of people, especially young people who've been involved in politics for the first time, are seeing Barack Obama as a transformational figure. And in many ways, he is and can be as president. The problem, of course, is that we don't have a constitution that lends itself much to transformational figures. The Constitution is filled up with checks and balances. It's intended to slow change and to keep change gradual and based on very broad consensus. And there are a whole lot of sticking points in there to keep majorities from overrunning minorities. So he's going to have to face that. On the plus side, though, I think he's going to come in with a sense that, you know, almost anything would be an improvement. He comes in not in the same situation, but in a similar way to Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, in that people had high expectations then too, but part of what they were thinking is it can only go up from here.
Mm-hmm. It was remarkable to see the response all over the world to this election, wasn't it? People were literally cheering.
It was. I think, despite the hits that we've taken in terms of our public image, people still do around the world look to the United States for not just economic and political, but also moral leadership. And I think we lost a little bit of that over the last 8 years. And part of the reaction to Barack Obama was not just that the Bush administration was leaving, but that you had a political figure now who spoke in those very strong moral terms. And also in terms of what he represented, that he represented the United States really coming to terms with its largest problem of the last, 300 years.
Thanks, Rick, for the call. Mike is next from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I'm a lifelong Republican conservative, and I did not vote for President-elect Obama, not because of his foreseen economic policies. I think, you know, most of them are fine. And I think the Republicans deserve to lose absolutely every seat conceivable because they handle everything just so disastrously. But I didn't vote for him just because of the national security issue. And I wonder what your guest thinks of, now that he's privy to information that he didn't have before, how much of a sobering effect has that had on him?
Well, I think it's very clear that, it's one thing to talk about, to criticize the current commander-in-chief. It's another thing to come in and do the job yourself. And he is, of course, learning things that he didn't know previously. The real tension for Barack Obama will be, how do you keep America safe while also maintaining the constitutional principles that many people thought were denigrated during the Bush administration? What do you do with the Patriot Act? What do you do with these laws about wiretapping? There are risks involved there. I mean, obviously, people expect Obama to move in the direction of greater constitutional protection, but there's a risk here that if he moves in that direction and a major terrorist attack occurs, whether or not it has anything to do with the changes that he makes, he'll still be potentially blamed for those.
Thanks very much for your call. Boyd is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Boyd.
Good morning, Kathleen, and hello to your guest. Well, you actually brought up earlier about potential candidates for Secretary of State, and I did catch a little of George Stephanopoulos the other day, and he mentioned four names, just in a nutshell, Kerry, Richardson, Daschle, and Hillary Clinton. Personally speaking, I don't think any of those would want the job. I think I could see Richardson maybe in an advisory role, but I don't think any of them would want the job. When you did mention names, I guess one, and you mentioned some Republicans previously, do you think Colin Powell might be interested in the job again, or possibly not?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, first to the Democrats, my understanding is, and I only know what I read too, but my understanding is that John Kerry is actually out there kind of actively campaigning for the job, so I suspect he may well want it. Bill Richardson, he probably would like, might possibly like another shot at the big time after having been in D.C. and now working as governor of New Mexico. So I think my guess is that Kerry definitely wants it and that Richardson might. Clinton may be less so. She may be seeing her future in gaining more power and prestige in the Senate. As for Colin Powell, that would also be a possibility. I'd forgotten about him before. I think that if he wants something, there will be a position for him in the Obama administration. Whether or not that's Secretary of State, I'm not sure. And certainly the choice of Powell would, I think, rub a lot of the liberal elements of the Obama coalition the wrong way. They still hold against Powell his performance in the UN before the Iraq war. But it would be, again, sort of a bold symbolic move.
The appointment that we do know is Rahm Emanuel to be chief of staff. What do you think of that one?
I think that's a pretty strong symbol that the discipline we saw in the Obama campaign is going to continue into the Obama White House. Rahm Emanuel is very well known as somebody who can, kind of keep the trains running very effectively. He's somebody who can, take care of people who are problems. But he's also kind of a link to the Clinton people. I mean, he's not, obviously, they're both out of Chicago politics, but Emanuel was really a Clinton person in the Clinton White House, and I think this is the first sign also of the opening of Obama's team to some outsiders.
And the press secretary, is it Bill Gibbons? Bill Gibbons, right?
Gibbs, I think it is. Gibbs. He, of course, was the press spokesman for the Obama campaign. And you're going to see roles for the key people there as well. I mean, you'll probably see David Axelrod, for example, in some kind of important capacity. But it's interesting because one of the advantages Obama has over recent presidents who are governors is these governors have a sort of ready-made team of people who expect to go from the state capital to Washington. And sometimes that's been kind of constricting because they come in with sort of a state capital mentality, as some of the Clinton people did from Little Rock, some of the Bush people did from Austin. Obama's not weighed down with quite so many people who expect to come with him, at least not from, a gubernatorial experience. And that allows him, I think, to cast his net a lot wider to find more people who, might be able to help him from the outside.
Being close to Chicago, I'm interested in whether or not Chicago is going to become the White House away from the White House. Do you know, or will it be Hawaii? We were talking with friends about that yesterday.
I don't know. I don't know where Obama will go for his recreation, or his rest and recreation, what the Western White House will be.
Yeah. Thanks, Boyd, very much for your call. We go to Rich next from Sauk City. Hi, Rich.
Hi. I was wondering, do you see any possibility of Obama doing anything about the actual political process? I know our country, we have the highest percentage of people incarcerated, and, you know, if you're convicted of a felony, you're not allowed to vote or hold public office. Do you see any changes there? And just briefly, you hear a lot about eventual reform of the marijuana laws. Do you see any possibility of that?
Well, on the first point about felon voting rights, he can certainly act from the bully pulpit there, but the laws that govern those sorts of things are primarily state laws, and there's not a lot a presidential administration can really do about that except to try to urge the states to move in a certain direction. As far as marijuana laws, I would be pretty surprised if the new president would do much there. I think that's kind of opening up a can of worms that would distract from some of the really fundamental things he's trying to do. That's kind of a hot button issue that would probably cause more controversy than it was worth. Now, one thing he might do is he might move the federal government in the direction of allowing the states a little more leeway with some of their medical marijuana laws. If he does that, I doubt it will be overt. I think it will just be sort of a gradual and subtle change in enforcement coming out of the Justice Department. But I don't think you'll see the president urging decriminalization or legalization.
Thanks for your call, Rich. Our number is 800-486-8655. One line is open now. It's All Things Political for this Monday, and our guest is Professor David Leneux, who is a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. We're looking at the transition now, the period we're in between the election of President-elect Barack Obama and the inauguration on January 20th, the press conference that took place on Friday, what your hopes are for this new administration, what you would like to have them tackle right off the bat, the meeting today at the White House, the appointments that have already been made, your response to that. Phone lines are open for you. And we have an email as well, which is talk@wpr.org. Randy is our next caller. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi, Professor Leneux. It's an honor to talk to you. I appreciated you replied to my email after your last visit. You're very insightful.
Well, thank you. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, I have a question. How does Obama, now that he's past the phase of being elected, which is one set of skills, sort out who he receives advice from when he looks out at lifelong Democrats? You heard the respectful Republican call in, and that gets at how wise it would be for him to place a Colin Powell. There'd be no downside. Colin Powell paid a price for his loyalty, and now he's seen by many moderate Democrats as somebody who fought a quick, fast, decisive war, knows how to do that, is strong, loyal. Those types of things are very popular among moderate Democrats, and those of us out here who have been lifelong moderate Democrats, like he was a moderate Republican, wonder, will there be voices like ours that can get through to Obama? And I'm just wondering, how will we know our voices are heard?
Well, I think one of the great strengths Barack Obama has shown in his short time on the national stage is his willingness and ability to seek out advice from people across the partisan spectrum. He certainly has a partisan voting record in the Senate, which is to say he normally supports the Democratic leadership. But in terms of the people he works with and gets advice from, you know, we talked before about Dick Lugar from Indiana, Chuck Hagel from Nebraska. He's already shown that ability to kind of move across the partisan lines. And certainly a selection of Colin Powell or Hagel or somebody like that would do that as well. I think that you'll know that Barack Obama is doing that because he'll very self-consciously and publicly do it, that you'll see him bringing these people into his cabinet, at least some of them, and also very obviously taking their advice. And I think he takes it seriously. I mean, I think he sees himself as a post-partisan transformational figure, and he's got to do that. He really has to show that he's reaching out to these people.
Thanks, Randy, for your call. Peter is next from Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm changing my question slightly because it was more about Bush than about Obama. What would President-elect Obama be doing about the hundreds of executive signing statements that Bush has left behind? Is that something that will be stretched out over years, or is he going to be overturning those in the manner that he'll be overturning the the last package of signings that Bush is going through right now, which Obama has specifically talked about eliminating?
Well, I think that's a really good question. He's going to go through certainly the executive orders, because those have the force of law. And as we said earlier, I mean, some of them he'll be maintaining, some of them he'll be canceling, and he'll certainly do the most canceling the most unpopular ones first. The signing statements are kind of interesting because the signing statements technically have no force of law, although obviously the Bush administration has been arguing that they do. It would be possible for Obama simply to ignore those. But probably in a symbolic sense, he'll probably want to make a bit of a show of making it clear that he's rejecting some of those as well. But the executive orders are more the first order of business because those actually do have the force of law.
Thanks, Peter, so much for your call. Ed is next from West Dallas. Hi, Ed.
Well, we already have seen that the one voice that Mr. Obama will not be listening to in his decisions is that of organized labor. On Friday, with the convening of the economic panel down in Chicago, the one glaring spot on the table that was vacant was that of organized labor. There was no representative from organized labor at that meeting. And Mr. Obama placed phone calls to Mr. Gettelfinger from UAW and Mr. George from ATU and Mr. Sweeney from the National AFL-CIO on Wednesday, thanking them for their support. And then on Friday, we were missing. And I think that this is going to be a continued practice in this administration. I'm going to be very interested to see who Mr. Obama nominates for Secretary of Labor. I think Richard Trumka would be an excellent choice, but would be very hard to get confirmed in the Congress. And I just think that we are going to be the forgotten voice, as Kevin Phillips stated on Bill Moyer's program on Sunday, this past weekend, on Friday night here in this market. This was a slap in the face to millions upon millions of people who went out and volunteered and did the get-out-the-vote work for this campaign.
Professor Lanoue.
Well, I think that is certainly a curious choice to leave representative labor out of that discussion. I don't know what, Obama's links to labor have never been as strong as Hillary Clinton's were during the campaign, or John Edwards, or some of the other people running. And so his relationship with organized labor has not been what a typical Democrat would normally see. My guess, and it's only a guess, is that Obama understands that he needs the support of organized labor, both in terms of his presidency and in terms of his possible reelection, and that you're likely to see a Secretary of Labor who will be more, who will be more acceptable to organized labor than maybe Secretaries of Treasury and Commerce and things like that.
So you could see someone like Robert Reich, who was at the table, be appointed again. Do you think he's in the mix?
He'd certainly be in the mix, but it could be actually somebody who's even more has even stronger links to organized labor than that. I mean, it's certainly And that would be a good place to do it, is in the appointment of a Secretary of Labor.
Thanks very much, Ed, for your call. We go next to Brandy from Lake Mills. Hi, Brandy.
Good morning. Yes, I'm calling with a question about your opinion on how effective you think that President-elect Obama will be in the long-term health care coverage for people, especially in terms of the aging population and going into nursing homes when some people don't want to be institutionalized and would rather be in more of a home-based. But when they do that, they often lose funding, and I'm wondering if you see any type of policy changes coming in with that type of issue. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Brandy.
Well, I think that's certainly something that the new president can look at. I mean, he's going to have to put something on the table in terms of health care, and I would think that he's going to be judged pretty strongly at the midterm elections and when he's up for re-election on what he does about the health care issue. He's got to get some legislation through. He simply can't have happen to him what happened to Bill Clinton. And I think part of what happened to Clinton explained the overwhelming bloodbath that the Democrats faced in the 1994 midterms, where they lost both houses of Congress. The caller's specific concern, I think, is one that you do hear a lot, and it's one that I think would be quite popular for Obama to address. But it will be in the context, obviously, of a comprehensive plan, and it's going to have to deal with both the realities on the ground in terms of the economy, what kind of money is going to be available, and what the process is getting it through the legislature, through Congress.
All Things Political for this Monday, November 10, with Professor David Lanoux from the University of Alabama, where he is professor and department chair in political science. 800-486-8655 is our number. A couple lines are open to you. Again, in a minute, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, National Geographic's November issue, has a fascinating article on the end of night, why we need darkness, and we'll be talking with the author of that article the second hour of our show. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Professor David Lanoux is our guest. Let's talk a little bit about the loyal opposition here now, the Republican Party, which seems to be in a somewhat confused state. Their role in serving with his administration, the problems there might be, the leadership. Who's going to emerge as strong leadership of the Republicans at this point in time, Professor Lanoux?
Well, I think, you know, John Boehner will probably end up remaining on as minority leader, but he hasn't, I mean, in the House. And his record has been pretty spotty. And he hasn't, I think, always, always made the best arguments for his party, at least publicly. But the real problem he's going to face is that the Republican Party, as losing parties often do, is currently kind of at its own throat. You've seen that partly in the leaks about Sarah Palin and the response from the Palin people. That's kind of a minor skirmish and a much bigger fight between the Republicans who think that they've gone too far to the cultural and social right and need to come back a little bit, be more of sort of a libertarian, socially moderate, economically oriented party, a party of limited government and lower taxes, versus the Republicans who think that the real problem was that John McCain wasn't a member of the base. He wasn't somebody who really energized people on the social issues. I forget which Republican was on television yesterday saying that the Republicans ought to start pushing more on issues like gay marriage and abortion. That's one side of the equation. The other side of the equation says that those arguments have lost middle America, and that's why Barack Obama did so well, not just in the cities, but also out in the suburbs. They have to resolve that problem first before they decide what kind of opposition they're going to be. Are they going to be an opposition that tries to moderate policy by working with the Democrats and not obstructing things? Or are they going to be an opposition of the sort that Newt Gingrich ran during the 1980s and early 1990s that really stakes out a strong, bold, economically and socially conservative agenda and uses tools like the filibuster to make the Democrats have to work for everything they get?
Mm-hmm. Let's go to an email. Mark from Spring Green. Obama wants to appoint Republicans to his cabinet. What about appointing progressive Democrats? So far, it seems Obama is appointing Clinton retreads and ignoring the progressives that voted him into office. He's adopting Clinton's triangulation strategy, which does nothing for Democrats.
Well, I think a lot of this is the symbolism. Let me say something that might be hopeful for your correspondent there. Possibly the symbolism of bringing in the Clinton people and the symbolism of bringing in moderates and not picking high-profile progressive and liberal Democrats in key positions at this point is that it allows some cover for a new President Obama to move policy somewhat to the left. It's easier to do that if you're not looking like a leftist than if you're starting to appoint a lot of people who immediately set off the alarm bells at all the Republican think tanks.
Let's go to Luba from Madison. Hi.
Hi. I have a question for the professor. First, I'll comment. Former President Bill Clinton signed an executive order requiring that anyone hired for his for an agency could not lobby for 5 years, and then before he left in 01, he revoked this executive office. And I don't believe that President Bush reinstated it. And do you think that Obama will bring it back?
I don't know. It's something that would be symbolically very appealing. If you're talking about new politics and you're talking about changing the culture in Washington, that's certainly something you can do. Now, of course, the reason that Clinton put it in was for exactly that symbolic reason, and the reason that that he rescinded it was because it's sometimes, unfortunately, in the context of Washington, difficult to bring in people who know that once they lose their job during the presidential transition, that their next best opportunity may be foreclosed for them.
Thanks, Luba, for your call. Let's go next to Wes from Madison as well. Hi, Wes.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question for your guest about the issue of transparency in the executive branch and what President Obama can do over the next few years to sort of redevelop a sense of trust in the American people and break down the cynicism that I think has developed in so much of my generation about our ability to just to be able to trust what we're being told. And do you anticipate a different approach, especially to the press, from an Obama presidency than what we've seen recently? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Wes.
Well, I think you're already seeing some of that. I think it was very symbolic that one of the first things Barack Obama did when he got elected president was go out and hold a press conference to signal to the media and to the American public that he plans to be out there, he plans to be accountable. Now, the problem is presidents always go into office claiming that they're going to be accountable, that they're going to hold a lot of press conferences, that everything's going to be transparent. And then, of course, they run into just sort of the inherent adversarial nature of the media, looking for problems, picking at various scabs. And a lot of them become increasingly insular as a result. Now, the Bush administration obviously is kind of off the charts on this, especially as it relates to Vice President Cheney's office. So I think it's almost inevitable you're going to see a more transparent, open administration from Obama than you had from Bush. The real key is going to be how that transparency holds up and how that relationship with the media holds up when things start becoming a little more problematic early on in the term.
What do you think is on, if anything, the president-elect's agenda today as he meets with President Bush? Is there something he needs to learn from the president?
Well, I think he certainly needs to talk to the president about some of the foreign policy issues. I know he's been briefed by some people in the foreign policy establishment. But one of the things you get from the president is kind of a sense of the presidency and how and what it. What it's like to be president. Now, I know he certainly talked to Bill Clinton, but their relationship hasn't exactly been the best. But I think this, to some extent, this is probably more of a courtesy visit, one where they'll sort of exchange pleasantries and talk about fairly broad topics. The other thing that they'll probably do here is try to work out some kind of transition plan where Obama people start getting placed in various White House offices or bureaucratic offices so that they can work with their Bush counterparts on the transition.
Hmm. Thanks for your call. And we go to Jim from Salt Lake City next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathleen. I don't think we'll see too many Democrats from the Senate appointed to cabinet positions, even though I would like to see Russ Feingold part of the administration. I think the only two exceptions is Massachusetts and New York, where those seats are safe, because I think that majority in the Senate will be very valuable in the next 4 to 6 years. Also, as for my pick, I think Bill Richardson, because of his experience with energy, being in charge of that, I think he'll be overseeing the BLM with all the oil drilling offshore, onshore, Alaska, and, you know, using that expertise. But I just think we'll just see a lot more new faces. And the last thing, too, is with the exception, I think there will be an offer to Senator McCain and Senator Lugar to serve with the Pentagon in some way.
Hmm.
Well, I think that, you know, the first point is very well taken. You know, the politics of the Senate, right now the Democrats are going to have about 57 or so seats, and that sounds like a fairly comfortable cushion, but it only takes an election or two to reverse that, and the Democrats, not in 2010, but in 2012 and beyond, are going to be the ones with the most seats vulnerable. So if you look at the long term, you got to be careful. Even if you pick a senator for the cabinet who is in a state where the Democrat is governor, the Democrat can choose the successor, that's still sort of an inherently weaker position than you are in with a veteran incumbent senator. So I think the call is right. I think you're going to see fewer senators from more marginal states end up on the cabinet. As far as Bill Richardson, there are a number of places he could be used. Secretary of State, Secretary of Energy, Secretary of the Interior. You know, he's somebody who could wear a lot of hats. And if the president perceives, the new president perceives that energy is going to be one of the most important portfolios, which it looked like it would be about
right.
a month and a half ago,
mm-hmm.
and now who knows, Richardson might be enticed to do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to, plus he endorsed him early, right? How much do you pay, do you think of somebody first just because they came out for you early?
Well, you know, it's politics. You have to make sure that the people who, you know, kind of put themselves on the line and took
right.
a chance for you are people who are going to be rewarded. Although in Richardson's case, I think, you know, his talents are so manifest that he'd be there anyway.
Mm-hmm. Robert from Fond du Lac, hi.
Good morning. How are you all doing?
Fine. How are you, Robert?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good.
I have a question. I know there's been an ongoing debate about campaign finance reform. And now since Barack Obama so blatantly prove that you don't need federal money to get into the presidential office, how do you think that's going to change how the finance reform is going to go? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
Well, you're quite possibly seeing the beginning of the death of public financing of presidential campaigns. The fact that Barack Obama was able to do this and finance not just an entire presidential campaign, but finance it in a very big way, really makes it, really, you know, if you look at what happened to McCain couldn't keep up. Somebody taking federal money couldn't keep up. I think both parties are saying, next time, we're not taking the federal money. We're going out and getting the donors online. And the funny thing is, and Obama's commented on this, in some ways, Obama's campaign truly was public financing in that he was taking hundreds of thousands of donations in fairly small increments from you know, ordinary Americans and adding them up into a large bundle. In that sense, you know, possibly we're in a kind of a post-campaign finance reform period, at least at the presidential level.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the campaign, it's unfortunate to have to say this, actually, because I think most of our audience really believes in public financing of campaigns. But some are saying that he was able to win the election partially because he had huge amounts of money.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it got him into the race as a serious candidate against Hillary Clinton in the first place,
mm-hmm.
and it allowed him to really overwhelm John McCain during the general election. And in a way, that's pretty important because whenever McCain sort of targeted an attack, Obama was able to be out there and just overwhelm him with cash, with ads in the swing states. And it made a huge difference, and both the Democrats and Republicans have looked at this, and they've seen model of the future.
Right. Thank you so much, Professor Leneau, for being with us. Enjoyed the hour.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Professor David Leneau, our guest for All Things Political this Monday after the election. He's a professor and the chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Alabama. And we'll continue our All Things Political. No reason not to. We're finished with the election, but there are many things to talk about. The transition period and the new presidency and all of the issues that we have talked about for years now. So next Monday, another All Things Political. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll continue our Monday conversation with a very interesting look at light pollution, which is something we haven't talked about very much. It has a profound effect on mammals and insects and human beings, perhaps, as well. So all that's coming up. And we first, though, will give you the news. This is the Ideas Network.